My name's Corey. I'm the day is October, was it 13th?
15th.
2018. And can we start by giving your full name?
My full name is Marilyn Politsky Santos. I go by Marilyn P. Santos as my legal signature.
Perfect. And when were you born?
Where?
When?
When? Mm-hmm. June 6,
1942. 1942. And where were you born?
Yonkers, New York.
Yonkers, New York. Where, in the hospital or at home?
Oh, in the hospital.
In the hospital? All right. Can you kind of just start talking about, you know, where you're from and how it was growing up in that area, or any memories you have?
Okay. Yonkers is a city right outside New York City. If you come out across the Bronx, The next city up on the west side is Yonkers. And it's a very hilly city. And that's where I grew up. Mom and Dad got married in Yonkers. My dad was from Port Chester, a little town not too far away. And my mom had been born in New York. Yeah, she had been born in New York.
New York City?
In New York State. And I think in Yonkers. Anyway, growing up, I remember our first apartment, and it was on Lane Street, and that was my first school. And I remember loving school, and I remember being an only child for about 5 years. Now, I was born in 42, so the war had was still on. My father enlisted. He was blind in one eye and had a child and a wife for dependents, and they took him anyway because he kept showing up, you know, Pulaski go home, and he kept coming back. And so they took him, and she was a little mad at him, but then became part of the war effort. And she was a stay-at-home mom. Most of the moms we knew at that time were.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't anything except middle class, maybe low middle class. But everybody was happy. Moms were always home, and you got to go outside and play in the streets, and you came in when the streetlights went on, or when you heard somebody call. So the whole neighborhood always knew where you were. We moved out of there out of Lane Street to a larger apartment after my brother was born. And so he's 5 years younger, so he was born in 47, and we moved up to a bigger hill, closer to the Hudson River, and it was a three-bedroom. I had some health problems, not health as in I couldn't live, but I had some unusual stuff, which I later learned. I was a 40s baby, the war was on.
Mm-hmm.
There were lots of things they didn't know technologically. And in 52, I remember being hospitalized for what they thought looked like jungle rot on my feet. I mentioned it because it was really kind of, I guess looking back, it must have been traumatic, though at the time I didn't think so. Hospitals didn't allow visiting hours. They had limited visiting hours. No children were allowed to visit. That prohibited my mother from coming to see me. If I was 10, he was 5.
Because she had to take care of him?
Because she had to take him. My father, when the war ended and he came home, took a job with the local newspaper chain and became head of the photo engraving department. They used to make all of the pretty pictures and all the display ads, and all the photos were done by metal plate. And of course, now you've got digital, so
yeah.
You have no idea.
Yeah, I was going to say, wow.
He worked nights. It was a morning paper, so he worked nights. And so he wasn't in the picture as much as my mom. Anyway, I went to school. We walked to school. When we went out to play, I can remember being able to walk all the way up to Undermeyer Gardens with my girlfriends, you know, when we were teenish. That was quite a ways away. That was a good couple of miles over hill, over dale, you know. And nobody
worried about
us. To school
was a couple miles?
Huh?
You walked
No, school wasn't that far.
Okay.
School was actually, I clocked it once when I went back. I thought it was far because it was downhill, uphill. Nah, it was maybe a little over 3/4 of a mile.
Okay.
That was the high school. But I remember in high school we used to walk out up to Untermeyer. It was a former estate of a gentleman with beautiful gardens, the nicest Persian gardens in the Western Hemisphere. Anyway, so that's the good stuff. The hospital stuff was not so good. They couldn't fix me, and they sent me home and said I'd probably never walk again. They were obviously incorrect. The one doctor said something that stuck with me. He said that I was probably allergic to my own bacteria.
So this, they said you had what exactly?
I had some kind of an open rash, open sores.
On your feet?
That they oozed, yeah, soles, instep, everything.
And this happened when you were...
I had it earlier, but, because I can remember sea salt baths, and my father would go to Long Island Sound, which was, gosh, awful polluted by that point, and would bring home water for me to soak my feet in. Mm-hmm. They had me urinate, and I soaked in my own urine, all kinds of stuff we tried. And nothing worked till my priest came in, he prayed, I prayed, I went home. I could not walk, it was because it was too painful. And I remember crawling to the bathroom, which we had a Pullman apartment, and so my bedroom was here and the bathroom was at the end.
Uh-huh.
And I could remember as I passed my parents' bedroom, I heard my father sobbing. I'd never heard him cry before or since.
Just because he saw you?
Well, because they told him to get a wheelchair. Anyway, something happened after the prayers, and or maybe it was just everything going, I don't know. I attribute it to God, you don't have to.
No, of course.
And I walked.
That's incredible.
I had trouble all through my adolescence with eczema and atopic dermatitis, and discovered then that the old stuff worked on me better than the new stuff. Cortisone creams were just out, the new steroids were, they were all. But the coal tar-based ones were really working better. And then there was the day I mixed all the samples together and put them on me, and that worked, and the doctor was really upset I hadn't measured.
Could have made a breakthrough.
Yeah, but that settled down. I got a good podiatrist, and she came up with a 3-ingredient cream, and that seemed to help. So I never had a problem there again. I had eczema, you know. And I notice now there are all these commercials on TV, get these magic pills. I'm like, don't do it, go back to the
just good old fashioned.
Yeah. Well, I was just lucky.
Do you remember what it was that you used?
It had magnesium and zinc in it, and I can't remember the third ingredient. Somewhere in the house in one of the boxes I'm supposed to go through someday, and I better get to it soon, is the prescription. I had her give me a copy.
Oh, really?
But if I find it and you leave me a contact, I'll send it.
That'd be incredible.
Yeah.
And so this was in, you know, when you were in elementary school, you were dealing with all this.
Elementary school when I was dealing with the on the feet stuff. Mm-hmm. The rest of the stuff went through my teen years.
Gotcha.
And then they did allergy tests on me. I never got past the first dosage of the shots. I had such bad reactions. My arm would swell up and that would just come down and then we go to, you know, I'd go back and do the other one.
Yeah.
So that determined a lot of my extracurricular stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But in school, I did very well and academically, and I had skipped a grade in elementary school, so I was kind of socially behind everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always, but I was tall, you know, and I knew what I was doing, so I got away with a lot of stuff. But I never was really quite comfortable with what was my new peer group because I was very sheltered. I was very sheltered.
Right.
In some ways, you know, we were allowed to go out and be unmonitored and walk off. You know, now I have my grandson in the store with me and I can't see him and I panic.
Uh-huh.
Though I did do that to my parents once, I remember.
Ran off or?
I didn't run off. We were in, I think it was Woolworths, and it was in Getty Square in the Yonkers.
What's a Woolworths?
Well, it's old Five and Dimes.
Okay.
W.T. Grant. Yeah, it's before your time.
Sorry, I just...
Like a general store.
Is it like
everything from my childhood is pretty much before your time. We took a trolley to go downtown, you know, and then that became buses. Anyway, I couldn't find them.
Mm-hmm.
And evidently, if they were looking for me, they weren't loud enough. So I remembered where we parked the car. Well, we parked it down by the Herald Statesman. And as a mother now, I die when I think what I did. No, I walked, and it was dark, and I walked down to the Herald Statesman, which was right by the train tracks and the square where all the winos and derelicts were. And nobody bothered me, thank you, God. But when my father was furious when they found me, my mother was just so glad I was there. You know?
Right.
And so I never did that again. And my children learned not to wander off.
Gotcha.
And that, I must have still been in elementary school.
I'm curious... You know, your father went into the war.
Everybody did. It was. If you ever get a chance, when you're not in school and interning, mm-hmm. and you have sleep, read The Greatest Generation. It's a bunch of stories edited by Tom Brokaw, and just ordinary people went in and did extraordinary things. I had two uncles that went into the Pacific arena.
Oh wow! Was your father in the Western and Eastern?
Well, you know, yeah, he was in, actually, he was in Fort Dix, New Jersey. He went from Fort Sill, Oklahoma to Fort Dix. He was visually impaired. He was blind in one eye from a high school basketball accident.
Oh, gosh.
And he could not see out of the other without his glasses. So
right.
The big kick when he went for Sunday afternoon drives, when he would take off his phone and ask my mom to clean his glasses, because we knew he was driving blind. My brother may not have known, but mom and I knew. So they kept him stateside, which was a smart move. He told her years later, a long time ago, after he'd been home for a number of years, that his unit was scheduled to go over to over to Europe, and it would have been in the D-Day group.
Wow.
And then I heard that, again, it's indirect, so I can't trace it, but that most of that unit had been wiped out. Some of my mother.
Yeah. Well, thank God.
And then he had good health there, as we could tell.
Mm-hmm.
I'm jumping around a lot. Is this going to confuse you?
No. It's fine. This is what I'd rather be like this.
1956, October 14th, 1956. We had one car, and I had grandparents who lived. My mother's people lived in Yonkers. My father's people lived in Port Chester. There was no public transportation, so you took your car and you went on the parkway and you drove up. And it was then about maybe a half hour, 45-minute ride. So they alternated weekends. One Sunday we'd be with Grandma in Yonkers, the other Sunday with Grandma and Grandpa in Port Chester. The Grandpa in Port Chester died in 1948 from tuberculosis.
Wow.
My mother's and father's people, my father's people were from, it was Russia then, I think, it was Austria-Hungary. They came before the turn of the 20th, before the 20th century. And they were from west of Minsk, so they were in what is now Belarus, or White Russia, or Belarus, Russia. I don't know what they're calling it now. My mother's people were also from Austria-Hungary, but they were in a section that became Poland.
Gotcha.
And as far as I know, everybody was poor. I think my father's people were more city people and did laborers. My mother's people were also more country people, and there were a lot of farms. And I remember my grandfather, Adamovich, it's my mother's father, being farmed out by his father to work on somebody else's farm so he could send some kopecks home. And he never ate turnips again after he got to this country.
Really?
Yeah. My mother said, family dinners, and especially at Easter and Christmas, there'd be this big plate of mashed turnips. My mother loved them, and the tradition was Grandma would bring it to the table and she'd pass it to the head house first, and he would say things, and probably in Russian, which is why I didn't always catch it, this is why I left the old country. And my mother said she never saw her father eat turnips after that.
Wow.
He wasn't thrilled with black bread either.
Interesting.
Funny people, good people, solid people. Church going and very steady.
So what did they do when they got here?
Whatever they could find. Mostly for work in the factories. They landed in Connecticut. I think it was Ansonia, and then they moved to Seymour, or it was the other way around. I'd have to check the family records, and I didn't do that. Grandma worked for something they called, it was like a button factory. And she came over when she was 14. She had a relative already here, and she was the youngest with her parents, and they begged Mama to let Mary come.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary came, and she came 2 years or a year before my grandpa. He was a couple of years older than she was. They came from the same little village. They'd never met.
Interesting.
Till they got to America. And
interesting.
Then, yeah, and then he wanted to get married, and she said no. And then she finally said yes, because he okayed it with the priest. There was something about somebody had died in the family, and she felt she couldn't do it. So the priest said it was okay. And then he wanted to buy a cheap little ring for the wedding, and she said, no, I want gold. And she got it, and she wore it every day of her life. She was feisty.
Yeah.
She was literate in English and in Russian, and probably all the other languages.
Right.
But she could handle money. She came with nothing, and they eventually... To put it in chronological order, my grandfather had had a massive heart attack and lived in a third floor walk-up at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctor came to the house and said, you can't do this anymore. you have to get. And they had saved enough where they could afford a house, and they bought a three-family house. Now, backing up a little bit, my father died in 1956. Grandpa's heart attack must have been 55 or thereabouts. My father died suddenly of a coronary. They called it coronary thrombosis in those days. Mm-hmm. It's what you call the widowmaker now. It did make her a widow. She was left with me. I was 14. My brother was 9. She had not worked while she was married. Prior to marriage, she had worked as a clerk in Woolworths.
Really?
That was the generation, no wife of mine will work while I'm alive.
Right.
Well, that was true. And then he was dead. He had discontinued his big GI insurance because he was in good health. He just had a physical two weeks before. They were, I believe, scheduled to close on a house through the VA shortly. Had they done that because they were war veterans and they were doing better things for them then, the mortgage would have been paid off. The only thing I ever heard my mother complain about was a kind of a wistful, she'd always wanted her own house and she never got it. Otherwise, she did everything she could. She didn't know how she was going to take care of us because there wasn't anything. There was a Nash Rambler. My father loved Nashes. And there were two children. She opted to keep the two children and get rid of the car. By then, she had a driver's license, though. As long as he was alive and well, he was driving. So then,
she didn't have one until that?
Oh, no. She had her driver's license. She pushed him for that, mm-hmm. but he insisted on driving. So I don't know that she ever actually drove the car, except when I wasn't looking.
Right.
She got her first job. The milkman. In those days, we had milk delivered to the house, and you know, he knew what had gone on. We were living up the hill after Lane Street. We were living on Park Avenue Terrace, and he bounded up the door, the stairs one day, pounded on the door. He says, "There's going to be a job opening part time at the library. Apply for it. Use my wife's name as a reference." My mother said, "I don't know your wife." Try this again, Nora. her name was Theodora. Everybody called her Dora, except me. I called her Mom.
Mm-hmm.
And she went down, and she was 40. She was 40 when she went down there. She got a job part-time at the library. She worked her way into a full-time position, and she retired from the library 23 years later.
Wow.
She loved it. She loved it.
That's true.
It was from her we got our love of learning and our love of books. Oh my gosh, she read to us and then she took us to the library and anything we wanted to check out, she let us. And you'll get a giggle out of this. Considering what 12 and 13 year olds know now, I was reading Jane Eyre and my father came home and he thought, "What are you letting her read that for? That's an adult." She said, "Oh, Al, cool it, she's reading."
That's impressive, though.
Yeah, but when you think about the things you worry now about
right.
12 and 13 year olds,
yeah.
that's the worst I probably ever did to that man.
How old was he when he passed?
He was 40. He turned 40 on September 30th. He died on October 14th. And for the rest of my mother's life, she never made travel plans to come visit me or the children till after the middle of October. She would not travel. She would not make plans for the fall visit or the winter or the Christmas visit till after the 14th of October. It was a horrible trauma for her. It was for all of us. And he died so suddenly. I remember for months after that, listening for his footsteps. You know, they never came.
Yeah, I can only imagine.
And she never, you know. And then the other thing that was different about those times is we didn't have mailings for solicitations. Like, I get tons of the mail, you know, donate here, donate there. People went door to door raising for causes. And I remember one day in particular, she answered the door and somebody was collecting for something, I don't know what, and she gave them her last dollar. And she turned around, closed the door, she said, "Oh my God, I just gave away my last dollar. How am I going to take care of them?" But we always had food on the table, we always had clothes on our beds, all her bills were always paid. God took care of us, and my mother took excellent care. And anyway, I did well in high school, and I got scholarships, and I got multiple orders, and I chose to go to Do you want any more in that era?
No,
that's okay.
No.
And then I went to Syracuse University. By that point, I'd always wanted to go into the helping professions, and I was really enamored of medicine. I was really interested in it. There were two doctors that practiced overseas, Albert Schweitzer, and I think that was Tom Dooley. He practiced in Southeast Asia. Turns out he wasn't as great a person as I thought he was, but I didn't care. But I was interested in medical. So when my father died in the hospital in Portchester, I was home studying for world history exam. Had I been there, I could have said, yeah, the pain here and the pain here and the sweats, that's a heart attack, guys, do something. But and I probably would have been vocal enough, though I was a very quiet person normally. And I still am, you can't tell by my babbling here, but they let him lie there for a very long time. He went into a coma and then they paid attention. They weren't busy, but my mother and my brother, my nine-year-old brother was there. He went to the door of somebody's house near the, off the parkway and asked to call his uncle, who was a policeman in Portchester, and he came, and by the time they got him to the hospital, looking back, because they had to do an autopsy, looking back from what our family doctor, Dr. Barbie, had said, they would have been so severe in those days, he would have been invalid. You didn't have what you have now, you know. So it worked out the way it worked out, and Mom made it work.
Yeah.
She never complained, and she worked to me, and she took care of us, and we cooked three meals a day, you know. And I don't know that I was all that much help.
Did she ever remarry or no?
No. And I have to laugh because she always wore her wedding ring and her engagement ring. And when she got older and she's, you know, she made it through the 40s. I think it was, she was in the 60s. And she said, I need a new wedding ring. And I said, no, oh, okay, Mom. She said, no. And she got a wide band. I have it. And I wear it. And I said, why, Mom? And she said, well, you know, these old guys, they think they can't see, and I want them to understand. I am not interested. I don't have it. Okay. She was really cool. She's a beautiful lady.
That is incredible.
I can show you the pictures if you want to move next.
We can do that. What did you study at Syracuse University? Mm-hmm. What did you study at Syracuse University?
Oh, I went in as a pre-med. I was a zone major.
You were pre-med?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then what did you?
Happened was organic chemistry. And I got interested in volunteering with the International Student Guides, helping international students. And I thought they were fascinating. I mean, some of them were really schlumpy. I mean, you know, you just want to hit some of them.
Yeah.
But it was, life looking back was very sexist, you know. I had one foreign student tell me one day, he says, you know, it's really a shame. He says, it's really a shame you're a woman. And I looked at him and he said, you're very bright. I thought, oh, well, that speaks volumes about your culture. I didn't get offended. I just thought, well, that's an interesting view. But I had fun doing that and showing them around and helping them out with their functions and all that. Anyway, that was an avocation. I was there at organic chemistry. I did something dumb to my right leg, and I think I sprained my ankle. I was on crutches. The chemistry building was one of the oldest, if not the oldest, on campus, and I was barred from the labs. Okay.
You were barred from the labs?
I was barred from the laboratories because I was a hazard. There were narrow aisles and you had organic chemistry and all these, you know,
vials,
compounds. Mm-hmm. So I'd missed enough where I thought, well, I'll take an incomplete. And I went to my advisor, who was the head of the chemistry department, and very anti-women in medical school. Women did not belong there. And I asked for an incomplete, and he said, we don't give that. You can withdraw, but it'll become an F. And I said, excuse me? I'm passing the course. Anyway, he said, that's it. I said, you have to make up all the labs. Well, I was not as careful about things then as I am now, but I had three experiments going. One of them blew up in my face and, you know, singed my eyebrows and my hair. And I went outside and sat on the steps, very logical, lit a cigarette, and I said, I've got all these labs between me and the people I want to help. I don't think I want to go this route. And I'm not going to get any support from this man.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he fought over things like what language I would take, what foreign language I would take. And I had come out of high school with Latin and Spanish. And I thought, well, I'll continue the Spanish. But I really wanted to take Russian because I thought if I learned Russian, I could speak to my grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
the short version of that story is I did take Russian. I got 2.5 years and I was really good at it. I came home and tried to speak to them. And that's when I discovered that, oh, I had been taught the academic, the educated Russian. They weren't speaking that. That's why they didn't use it in the house, because this part of the country didn't talk to this the farmers.
Right.
So they were speaking dialect. So that was, you know, a wasted intercultural reaction with my grandparents.
Were you able to communicate with them at all?
Well, we could do it in English.
Right, in Russian?
I have one piece of a tape, audio tape, where my grandmother does a whole sentence in English. Whoa! You know, you can figure it out hand and foot.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, so at that point, I become popular among the administration for my volunteer work. So I just can't do this. You know, and I'm not taking an F for this course. There's no reason why they can't work with me, if he's being stubborn. And I thought, well, I want to work with these people. I'll go into international relations. I will save the world. You know, I have ideas. I'm good. I can do this. So I did. I waltzed across the campus, and I saw the dean, and he said, well, yeah, you can switch your major and you can go into international relations, but here's the deal. And you can take an incomplete in this course. You can take a W. It will stay. It will not become an F. To this day, it hasn't become an F. But what the caveat was, you haven't taken city and state government, all the things that a poli-sci major would take going into international. He said, just don't say anything. See what happens. As long as you do well, no one will catch it.
Wow.
And I did really well, and no one caught it. However, what goes around comes around. I went from Syracuse. My academic advisor there said, there's this new place opened up at the University of Hawaii. My mom had always wanted to go to Hawaii. I thought it would be nice, but she really always wanted to go. There she was in New York working in the library. And I thought, well, he said, apply. They're taking 2 people from each state. You apply. And I was in the Maxwell School of Citizenship and Public Affairs at that point. It's an excellent school to this day. And I said, okay, so I fill out the application because my choices were go to work, what am I going to do? And or go to a graduate school. So this sounded good, so I applied. And I got in.
What year was that?
That was 1963. I graduated from college.
Gosh, yeah.
And Syracuse was a good experience for me. It's a Methodist school, or was at the time. I guess it still is. High Jewish population, lots of internationals, and I was exposed to a lot because I grew up in not a ghetto, but you know, I was Russian Orthodox.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody around me was Roman Catholic or Protestant. And that was the big split there.
Right.
I was the one that worshipped at the what they call it, the Onion Dome Church down at the in the Hollow. You know. So anyway, Syracuse was interesting, and I got a lot out of it, and that changed my perspective on the universe a little bit. Well, going to the University of Hawaii, I mean, talking about falling in love with a place as soon as my feet hit that floor. Well, as soon as I saw the ocean, I could see my feet.
Yeah.
Standing up to here in the water. I couldn't get out. I'd swim in Long Island Sound. Yeah. It's a wonder I didn't die. Anyway, so I was out there for a bit. I was on full scholarship, paid for everything, including toothpaste. Our job was to relate to each other.
Mm-hmm.
So we automatically got a roommate from a different culture. And my roommate was a young Thai lady. I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway, she was lovely. And I was very tall. And in their culture, the taller you are, the older you must be. And I was like 4 years her junior, because they were graduate students for the most part coming over. They were already established. They were like, anyway,
mm-hmm.
Wonderful experience, eye-opening. Oh my God, goodness, eye-opening. And I think that's where we fail in this country. We don't open people's eyes to other things.
Right.
You show them somebody who's different, and God forbid black or brown or yellow or green or whatever, and they get scared, and there's nothing to be afraid of. You know, different isn't bad or good. It's different, you know, and you learn the ways of the culture, just as you asked about your shoes coming into the house. I mean, it's But we're not, I think, that we are not as sensitive to that which is around us anymore. Our interpersonal skills have gone down considerably because of them. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so I was out there. It was a wonderful experience. I did not do the whole term for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, when you think you've got the world outsmarted and make plans and God laughs at you and shows you. I was interested in South Asian politics, India, the subcontinent, India and Pakistan. Of course, when I started school, it was India. You know. Mm-hmm. And they decided to close that in favor of South and Southeast Asian and Pacific. And that made sense. So I had to leave international relations, and that left political science. The dean there called me in, and he asked about my background, and he said, you understand, I cannot let you have a master's in political science until you take the undergraduate courses. Uh-huh. That was a lot of courses to make up. So that contributed to my leaving and giving up the grant. Mm-hmm. I took a leave of absence from the grant. I came back to New York. I helped my mom out with my brother. He had been ill at the time. And he was better by the time, shortly thereafter. And I worked in New York City. I worked at a council for foreign students. And I went over to the Rockefeller Foundation, which was doing really interesting work. And I stayed there for a while, and then I went to Pace University, and I did editorial work for them on in-house publications and their catalogs, and I was up in the executive floor with you, and earning a pitiful salary, because salaries were low, and I was a woman, I didn't realize. When I quit there, I had decided at that point, I'd done some tutoring of languages, and I had tutored really since high school. We had two boys from Hungary come over after the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, and I helped them with English. And it was very interesting because my name was Marilyn Poletsky at that time. And, you know, that was my Russian middle last name. And Stephen had seen his parents gunned down in the streets. And so I was Polish. And that was the end of that conversation. I was just his Polish friend. Okay, all right. And I could understand that. And I thought, well, you've got empathy. I was young. I was dumb. I really thought I could do a lot of stuff and make a difference. And I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make it better. So I helped them out. John became a doctor. I don't know what happened to Stephen, but I'm sure they did well. They were hard workers and were both bright. Mm-hmm. They had a lot of sadness in their life. Anyway. Back to me. I was standing. Oh, I know. I went in and I asked for a raise. The president of the college met with me. I had asked for, I think,
This is at Pace?
This is at Pace. $10 a week. Didn't seem like a whole bunch. Because I was doing all this good stuff. And he looked me square in there and said the college couldn't afford it.
What was minimum wage? Just curious.
Gosh, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure I was close to it. I don't remember a lot of things. After my father died and I had been studying for the world history exam, I didn't realize till I was in my 40s that was the reason I no longer was able to remember dates so quickly. I really have to work at dates, and so I can't tell you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I can tell you what things were, maybe. Oh, don't get up without asking permission. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, you're totally
fine. This is your room. You can do whatever you
want. Anyway.
Did you need to get something?
I was going to, but it can wait. Anyway, I don't remember. It was low. Because I can remember working for $1.75 an hour.
And so when you were, and this is just something I was thinking about when you're talking about college and all the issues you had being a female in that college. How many female students were with you at Syracuse?
Oh, yeah. Well, I lived in a female dorm, so most of my friends were female, except for the males that I, and most of my male friends were either in international relations or international students. Mm-hmm. One of our resident advisors in the dorm was an Indian lady. I liked her a lot. It's nice. Anyway, so the ratio, I don't know what the ratio was. I went in liberal arts, mm-hmm. and, Forrester was obviously more male, medicine was more male. Because I studied Russian in Syracuse, I got interviewed by the NSA and the CIA.
Oh, really?
I did poorly. Boy, you could get a secret out of me. You know, threaten somebody and tell me I'm responsible.
Yeah,
now I say, oh, no, really? Because I know you're going to kill him anyway.
Wow.
You got interviewed by the CIA?
Yeah, they just because of the Russian. I did really well in it. I loved it.
Yeah.
Even though it was, according to my original advisor, too hard.
Right.
Nonsense. Take a baby from any place in the world and dump them in another culture, they learn it.
Right.
But I didn't know all that stuff. You can't get wise in everything all at once. So,
And then when you were at Pace and you asked for the raise.
Oh, I asked for the raise and he said no. And I thought, oh, that's a bummer. So I thought about that for a while. And I was on a leave from the University of Hawaii. And I thought, I wonder if I could get back in. And so I wrote them. And I said, I don't want to go back into, bless you.
Oh, thank you.
Don't ever stifle it, blame raid someone. I used to say. They said, yeah, you can come back in. And I said, okay, we'll send you the form. I said, okay. And I'm changing fields. I decided by then that I wanted to go into their TESOL program. They were at the time number one in training teachers to be teachers of English to speakers of other languages. I said, this is it. I get to work with those people.
Right.
I get to learn stuff. I get to teach. I'm in command in my classroom. I can do this. Yeah. But, it wasn't a definite commitment until he turned me down. When they turned me down, they had to get replacements. I do not lie. Two gentlemen who were already working for the college took over parts of my job at a much higher salary because, and I quote, they have families.
Wow.
That's what it was like. And I wasn't like all these feisty women who go out and say, I can't do that. I thought, well, I'm just me, you know. And I'd always been a white minority,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I thought, well, all right, you know. Yeah. Anyway, most of my schoolmates growing up had been in the country. Their people had been in the country longer than mine. I mean, everybody's an immigrant. Even the Indians were an immigrant. They get good press because there was nobody here, you know, but everybody else that came after.
Mm-hmm.
They're immigrants. Okay. So I went back to Hawaii, but this time I was on my own. Had a roommate, worked full-time in Waikiki. I was so bad at selling things, they put me in the cash register. I could do money. I couldn't sell you food if you were starving. And so I went full-time to graduate school. On the days when I didn't have early classes, I'd drive down to Waikiki and I'd sit and watch the sunrise. And the work crew would be there and they'd make coffee over their fire, put the fire, and they would give me a cup and I'd go, oh, that's nice, you know. And I'd go for a swim, come back, read some more. And I learned a lot about the native Hawaiian culture that way.
That is awesome.
Yeah, so it was really, and the whole experience starting with the East West Center was just mind blowing. It changes what you want to do and where you want to do it and how you want to do it. Because everybody, if you can find your passion, it's really exciting. So then I met this man who was in the Navy, and I was not at all interested, but I had known his mother and she introduced us, and he was just back from the Battle of Long Beach, California. This was during the Vietnam War. And I met him in 1969.
Was this while you were still in Hawaii?
Yeah, okay. I finished up my degree in December of 1969. And I got a teaching job in Hawaii. And I was really happy. And
who were you teaching?
Huh?
Who were you teaching?
I was teaching mostly plantation children who were there for the pineapple and the sugarcane. I was in Wahiwa, which was pineapple country at that time. And so I had students that were Thai, Filipino, Pacific Island, pretty much it.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, nice kids. And I wasn't that much older than they were. You know, so where are we? I taught at the high school and the middle school. People who teach at the middle school for a long time are saints.
Right.
You walk into the classroom and you know how mixed it is, you know, with one day I'm an adult, and the next day, you know, I'm a 2-year-old. And then they found out about me at the elementary school because they didn't have and I'll come down and teach. Well, I knew nothing about children except for my brother, and he never listened to me, even though I was in charge with it after Mom went to work. And so, you know, the music teacher saved me. I thought, I've got to learn about children if I ever do this again. But in the meantime, I'm going to stick to the older ones. And my husband, he was in the Navy. Rick was in the Navy, and he was getting out of the Navy. He didn't want to go to Vietnam, and it was the end of his enlistment. So, but then he also wanted to get married. Stay in Hawaii, why would we do a thing like that? No, he wanted to go off and see the States, and he went to Long Beach to be discharged. And we got married first, and he went to Long Beach to get discharged. And then I joined him, which means I gave him my teaching position, which was coming along. I was doing better, you know.
All right.
And we were poorly equipped. Everybody was, you know. So if I had the tapes, the other teacher 10 miles away had the tape recorder, we'd meet on street corners and exchange and share. We just shared. You worked your lesson plans around what kind of support you had. And then I was a Navy wife. I was a Navy wife. He had gotten out. So we're going across country. He wants to take the southern route, and he wants to go through Alabama, Mississippi. He said, are you out of your mind? And he said, why? And I said, look at you. Look at me. Because he was Hawaiian, Japanese, Guamanian, Filipino.
Oh,
so he was by nature of darker complexion.
Right.
In the sun, in the ship. I mean, he was really dark. In fact, when they had the children later on, I would say things like, which one am I waving to? Because I couldn't see distance for anything. And I was always waving to the black guy up there, you know. Mom, that's Dad over there. Anyway.
So how did you meet him exactly?
His mother introduced me. I worked in a muumuu shop in the Outrigger Hotel. And in the back was the Blue Dolphin Room. And I had friends.
What type of shop? What's a muumuu shop?
Hawaiian dress, the muumuus, and the aloha shirts.
Okay, I'm sorry.
And I used to, when I had money, I would go back and I would get a drink. I'd have one Bloody Mary because, logically, tomato juice, celery, right?
Healthy.
Good for you. And, you know, one shot of vodka is not going to kill me. And then we got, they were very good to me. If I was, because I would close the shop late, and then on days when I didn't have class, once in a while they said, come have breakfast with us. And that's how I met her. She was one of the waitresses.
Gotcha.
At the place we went to have breakfast. And they would buy me breakfast. Oh, food, meat, eggs. You know, so right. Exciting. And they were nice people. And one of them was, they were all fine entertainers. And one of them was a renowned slack key guitarist. I knew nothing about this. I just knew I loved their music and I loved them, and they were very kind to me. She was in one night with her husband and this man that was her son, and he got up and performed. My husband had been who's very musically gifted. He couldn't read music, but he could hear something. Taught himself to play piano, guitar, and ukulele. He was excellent. He had a fine singing voice too, and he could work a crowd real well. He's quite an entertainer. Anyhow, so that's how we met.
And he was in the Navy at that time.
He was in the Navy. He had just been transferred to a ship in Pearl Harbor. She was tired. She had to go to work. She said, we talked. I said, well, I don't have class tomorrow morning. I'll take him back to Pearl Harbor. I've never been on the base before. And so so I did. And he was interested. I said, A, you're younger than I am. B, I'm very busy. I'm a graduate student. I've got a research project that my professor found for me. I'm doing that. I'm studying full time. And I've got this muumuu shop I'm taking care of. I haven't got time for this. Go find somebody who's got time. And I think because I said no, I think if I just said yes, he'd realize we had nothing in common,
mm-hmm.
You know, but he didn't. And he persisted. And he was so sweet. I mean, he would bring me food all the way from Eva Beach, you know, while I was at the university doing research. And he'd just bring food and then he'd go away and then he'd call and he'd go away. And so we dated, and that's all, you know, that was my social life too.
When was that? What year was this? Sorry.
That was in 1969. We started, I met him on September 30th, which was my father's birthday.
You remember the day you had where you first met him?
Yeah, September 30th.
That's incredible. Yeah.
Because that was my dad's birthday and I had to work.
Mm-hmm.
My dad was already gone. I just always remember when his birthday
right.
was. And that's when I met him. And we got married the following May 23rd.
Wow. And one year later?
Yeah, in 1970. And then in June of 1970, we went to Long Beach, and then we were doing this drive cross country. And what we did was we didn't rent a car. They had these services where you could drive somebody else's car, which you had to keep to the route and the schedule. And he wanted to take the southern route. And I thought, no, no, honey, we can't do that. I mean, I'd been in civil rights, and and my roommate had been with the Selma March, and oh, wow. She knew the boys that were killed and buried in the levee.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. That's what saddens me and probably irritates me, too, is that we don't give enough remembrance to the people who did that. We don't give enough remembrance to the civil rights unit movement, and we don't treasure what they did, and we don't act up to the standards that were set. You can change laws, but you can't change people, you know, and people, if they want to hate, will always find somebody to hate. But never in all my life have I seen it be made so publicly acceptable as it is now. And that just saddens me and scares the heck out of me.
In comparison to back in the 60s?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, people hate it. But they weren't given public venue like they are now. They weren't, you know, don't be gentle with them when you put them in the car kind of stuff when you arrest them, you know. And it's coming from 45 on down, and I don't like it. I really don't like it.
So just this might be a little off topic, but just a question. Do you think it's worse now? You said it is worse now than it was back in the 60s?
It wasn't worse. Yeah, I grew up in the North, and Yonkers was taken to court many years after I left Yonkers for segregated schools, because they were segregated neighborhoods. Now, I wasn't aware of it because where I lived after we moved in with my grandparents in the three-family house, it must have been, that was 1957, to the time I left in 63, our house was then only a couple of blocks from where the projects were. I don't know whether they were all black. I think they were mixed, but we had black students in our school. And one of my best friends I went to Syracuse with, she was black. Now she's what they called in those days high yellow. She was light black. Yeah. Her skin tone was about yours. And I remember rushing a sorority with her, and they would take me and not her because we don't take that kind. And I thought, well, you don't take this kind either, honey. And I just walked, and I never looked back. And at any so I just stopped. Now, a sorority did take her, but not that one. I would just, how can you? She's such a sweet, wonderful person, and she said, I mean, my friend, and you did. No, you can't do that.
Still makes you mad to this day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So that's that kind of stuff was going on, but if you hated a group of people, you weren't given a comfortable public venue.
Back then?
Yeah. Now, I don't know about South at all. I never wanted to come South.
The Mason-Dixon line?
Yeah, I never. Florida wasn't even on my map.
Right.
The places I wanted to go. But that's how it happened. Anyway,
sorry, yeah, back.
No, that's okay. No, that's a good question.
No, that's right.
Yeah, because this is all history to you.
And it's very
relevant.
And
not very well
now.
Taught history, depending on where you went. Don't, you know.
Well, it's good to see. It's good to have someone's perspective that lived it. You know, I can read about it.
I can remember Jan going, now I couldn't afford to do it. And I guess I was more chicken than she was, too. I scare more easily. I still remember my NCAA, my CIA interview.
Yeah. Shaking.
Well, yeah. They hook you up and they ask you all these questions. And I and the group that I was in, we were all so naive, you know. And I look at what kids know now, and I think, oh, where's your childhood? You never had one.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, it was more of an age of innocence. I can tell you exactly where I was when Jack Kennedy was killed. I can remember who told me.
Really?
I can remember Bobby Kennedy dying on my birthday, the day after he was shot. I can remember Martin Luther King. And it changed America. Right, if you got to go out and do these things. You know? Anyway. And for all the bad press that Lyndon Johnson gets, he was the one that pushes civil rights. He and Bobby were the ones that wanted the Civil Rights Act.
Right.
John was more cautious. Didn't want to upset people.
So Johnson was in the 60s.
Johnson was the vice president when John Kennedy was killed.
Right. So he was dealing with the Vietnam issues, right, mm-hmm. after JFK had passed.
Yeah. I was up, I was at the East-West Center when Kennedy was killed. And it was he who had put together the East-West Center of this place of cultural interchange and free minds and wonderful libraries and original sources for historical documents. It was just, and I remember, you know, we were all in mourning. None of us had ever met him, but we were all in mourning and for that poor woman, you know. And then to sit on your black and white TV and watch his killer get shot by some man who was allowed to come into the police station with him, you know. Oh. And Lyndon Johnson, in comparison, was not well-loved. He was a politician, and he could play dirty, and I bet you that's how he got all those lost through.
Right. But he did pass a fair amount of the Civil Rights Act, right?
Well, almost all of them. It was on his watch they got passed.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Yeah. So back to, sorry, that's for the, okay. for the drive see. Back down.
Oh, the drive across. So, just, anyway. So we get to Utah.
Utah. Interesting.
Northern state. Well, we were up in Northern California. We were in can't remember the city. It'll come to me. Not right now. But anyway, we were traveling across California. We went up into Utah, which was predominantly white. And we were having breakfast someplace, and these guys at the next table started saying things. So my husband, I think, Rick, A, you're short. You're one person. You're short. There are four of them. Eat your breakfast and let's just get out of here.
Started saying things to him?
Yeah, not to me, to him.
Mm-hmm.
And so we did, and he was really upset. I said, now, you see why we're not going south? One or both of us would be dead, because things were still pretty rough. This was 1970.
Do you remember what they said? I mean, no, I understand if it's too... No.
I just remember he got upset. I was really reunited with my husband. I'm, you know, on a cross-country drive. I'm having a wonderful time. This is not my first cross-country drive, but it's my first one this way, you know. So we made it to, we stopped off at Baltimore to visit an old friend from the East-West Center, and then went to New York to visit to stay with my mother until he figured out what he was going to do with his life. He wanted to be an entertainer. By the time he had entertained in a few places along the route, he realized he could not afford to, he couldn't make a salary that way, so we had to be stable in some place, you know, where we could both work. And when you talk about prejudice, my grandparents, you know, you should marry a nice Russian boy, preferably, well, you should be Orthodox, preferably Russian. So I'm thinking my grandmother, oh my gosh, she lived in the first floor apartment, and I didn't have the key to my mother's house. To get it, I had to walk up through my grandmother's apartment, go up the back stairs, and get the key out from under them and get into the house. So we pull up, and I'm thinking, it's summer, and he couldn't be darker. Well, let's see what she says. Hopefully she'll say it in Russian. So I walk in, and he'll wait in the hallway. And she smiles, and she closes the door, and she's walking me through the apartment. She said, I thought he'd be taller. I thought I would fall over. I laughed so hard all the way through the apartment, up the stairs, across my mother's apartment. I was still laughing when I opened the door. Because I thought she'd say he was like tall.
Right.
Didn't think he'd be so dark. No, I thought, because he was 5'7". I was 5'9 or 10 at the time. Anyway, don't eat. And I thought, well,
there we go.
Much for stereotyping your own family. It's shame on you. I laughed. He was not amused by that at all, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, by then he decided he needed to reenlist, so he went down to Brooklyn, he reenlisted, and then we got stationed to Newport, Rhode Island. He was assigned to a ship that was in the yards in Boston. So we drive up to Newport in our little green Volkswagen, and he puts me in Mrs. McGillicuddy's boarding house, and he takes off to Boston. I'll see you on the weekend. I'm okay, fine, he'll come home. He couldn't remember where he put me when he got back to Rhode Island, but he found me eventually. And this is before cell phones, so you know, if you're lost, you're lost, you know. And we found an apartment, and we stayed there. Both my children were born in Newport. He was on shore duty when I got pregnant. He was on the ship during the pregnancy. They went, were scheduled for, my son was born on January 2nd, 1970. The ship was supposed to leave in December, I can't remember the date, for Roosevelt Roads in Puerto Rico, and then from there they were going across the Atlantic and doing a med cruise. He got permission to stay till I had the baby. Oh, they induced that baby, they induced that baby. I thought Dr. McDonald was going to jump up down my belly there for a while. And, you know, and I drank tea and I went for walks. Come Super Bowl, day, well, New Year's Day and all the games, I went out about 6 o'clock and I got his watch from him. I went back in the bedroom. I waited and all day patiently gone for walks. I'd had my tea in between games. Games were over. He got me, but I let him get undressed and everything. I said, "You have your attention now?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Good. I think we need to go to the hospital." It was, and so it was a long labor, but he came out well. I went toxemic on them.
You did?
Yeah. They're drinking little rum drop things. I'm not getting anything. Well, they had the doctor who delivered me was Puerto Rican. And they were celebrating the New Year, just little medicine cups. They weren't drunk.
Uh-huh.
And the baby finally came out. Then he was home.
And when was he born?
January 2nd, 1970. 7 pounds, 11 ounces,
and
22 inches.
Vaginal
Richard K. Aloha Okalani Sands, don't say it. yeah. And then my mom came up to help me out, and Rick flew back to met this his ship in Puerto Rico. That med cruise became an around-the-world cruise with a scenic stop in Vietnam. He got to go off the ship and go on one of those river boats, I think. He came back different.
After Vietnam?
Yeah. World War II vets didn't talk about anything. I can remember my uncles never talked about the military. My father, because he'd been stateside, could, but he didn't.
Mm-hmm.
They did what they needed to do for the country, and they came back. Vietnam was different. The climate was different. People were not welcoming of the war effort. And you can be against a cause, against a mission, but you can't hate the individual, every individual. And they did. I had a friend whose husband was in the Army, and when he came in from the West Coast, he was told to go into a bathroom and change to the civilians as quickly as possible. They were spit on in the airports.
When they came back home?
Yeah. Anyway, the Navy wasn't so bad because we pulled back into a ship, you know, into a shipyard. Yeah. But he was different. He and his buddy Tom got drunk one night in the house. And they talked about it. That's the only time I heard them talk about it. But Rick was different. He stopped going to church. He was just different.
Do you remember what he said when he talked about it? Do you remember what he talked about when he was talking about it?
I think it was mostly, I don't remember specifically, but I do remember, if I had to categorize, it was kind of a loss of how could anything like that happen? You know, how could we be part of that? Why are we, you know? And it was another loss of innocence, I think. You know, and it seems like in my personal experience, there were a lot of those losses of innocence, you know. The personal ones of losing a parent so suddenly, then the political ones of losing a president. Oh, she's a president. A loved president, you know. Then who shoots his brother? I mean, you know, somebody else. And then Martin Luther King and some, all hoping to stop something or express their hatred. And then the horrible things that happened in the South during that period,
right.
And then before, you know.
And you said you had friends that were part of the Zone Marches.
And then you know, I read and I knew about these things, and how can you kill a 14-year-old boy for being in the air and you think looking at a white woman, you think you can't get pregnant that way. He can't hurt you. He's 14.
Right.
He probably can't unzip his own pants. You know, leave him alone. I just. So I think to come in contact with actual physical violence on that on a national level must have been horrible. And sex crimes, there was no way to report them. It was always the woman's fault, at least it seemed to be. There was no way of tracing, they didn't have DNA. People, I don't even know if they took DNA swabs in those days.
So from all of your experiences, what advice can you give to, you know, the people of today? What lessons did we learn from, you know, experiencing all these?
Lower your filters, see people for being individuals, don't lump people into groups. Those children that are in cages and tent cities because we're keeping out illegals, what right have we got to do that to children? We were stationed in Germany in our last tour before we came to Florida. And I took, we went to Dachau, the camps, yeah. The museum there. I had to take my daughter out. She was too young. She was born in 74. We were there in 84. She was way too young and too sensitive. I had to take her out. And you see where the town was and you see where the furnaces were. And you think, how did they not know? Well, they probably did know. And now with what I know of psychology, and I can see where, you know, you do a little bit, you take a little bit here and nobody else is complaining, so you don't. You know, how many times you've been at a party and maybe you haven't felt right with what's going on, but you don't say anything. Well, you magnify that by things the government does. And they tell you things, and your neighbors tell you things, and you just go with the flow. And the courage it must have taken to hide people during World War II.
Right.
So, what I say is don't ignore the signs of infringement on rights. Don't ignore hatred. Don't be silent. Now, am I guilty of silence? Oh, gosh, I must have been, you know. But see people as individuals. Know that different is not scary. Scary is somebody pointing a gun at you. Scary is somebody beating up just because you are you. And pay more attention to nonverbal clues. We're not taught that anymore. I don't know whether in the course of your training you've had any interpersonal courses. I'd recommend them highly. I would also recommend, if you've not had them, taking a Myers-Briggs personality preference test to see what your basic type might or might not be. You know, where do you get your energy from other people or from being by yourself? How do you deal with the world? Are you intuitive? Do you see the future or do you just solve the problem? Do you make judgments by, well, do you make decisions based on your emotions, your feelings, or are you logical and straightforward? You know, how do you do it? Know that about yourself. There's no wrong to that. We're all put together differently. And what was the last one? Oh, how do you do time? Are you, you know, like me, are you kind of flexible with time? More than kind of flexible, very flexible. Or are you, you have to have a schedule.
Right.
My best friend, I can say every day of the week what she's doing and when she's doing it, pretty much, unless she's doing something, you know, special. But even then she'll tell me I'm having lunch with, you know.
Right. To keep you up, dude.
But me, I get up in the morning, unless on days when I have my boy, you know. Yeah. Oh my gosh, I've been talking. Be kind. If you can't be anything else, be kind. And listen. And I don't know how you teach a whole universe. I'd like to see ethics brought back into every curriculum. And I'd like to see citizenship brought in as part of a piece of the curriculum. Understand that we have a responsibility as citizens. It is our right and our privilege to vote, but we have the responsibility to use it. Of all the nations that are in our industrialized class, we have the lowest voting. We take for granted what we've got. And we've become polarized, and we let these people in Washington also be polarized. I don't know how you bring back public service. There are many people who are committed to public service, and they are probably in the federal service. And there are some very fine ones in public service. I didn't agree with a lot of John McCain, but I admired and respected that man, and he was always true to himself and true to the country. He was a patriot, in the good sense of the word.
I don't know. I had a question.
Yeah.
You know, you had the hospitalization when you were young with your feet, and have you ever been in hospital since
then? Oh gosh, yes.
Yeah. I assume so.
Yeah.
What do you mean?
My goal now is not to ever do it again. Most recently, I had a stroke. Back up to my toxemia and the fact that every time I went to the doctors for my annual physicals, they say, "How are you?" "I'm fine," and except I'm always tired. And I was by then had Graves' disease. It's in my early 20s. I was diagnosed in New York. Oh, but I was beautiful. I was young. I was stale. I could eat anything in the house. And nothing. Oh, but I didn't pick up anything sharp when anybody was around me because I had a lot of inner hostility. I thought I was going crazy. So I went to the family doctor and said, "I think I'm going nuts, doc." And he couldn't find anything wrong. They did all the blood because you're not crazy. I said, "Well, I feel very." So he sent me down to a specialist in New York who came up behind me and put his hand in my throat. And he said, "How long is you having?" And I about killed the man because my reflexes were really good.
Yeah.
And I said, "I don't know." And so he ran thyroid tests on me. And that was in 1965. Yeah, thereabouts. So I was on Tapazole for year and a half, 2 years. I was in Hawaii when I was still on Tapazole. Went to a place called Straw Clinic. It was a private clinic, a lot of doctors. Got this wonderful damn man whose name is, I can't remember. And my hair started to fall out, which is one of the side effects. You know that. And so I went and he said, "Well," after he got all the results, he said, "You stop this, but we have to do something. And you have two choices. You can have the surgery, or you can take the radioactive treatment." I said, "There's a third choice. I don't have insurance. I can't afford this. I can barely make my bills, you know, now." And he said, "So what are you going to do?" I said, "I guess I'm not going to do anything." He said, "Sit down. Sit there." Okay. He got on the phone, and I don't know that this happens anymore. Certainly not in a big place like Shands. I don't expect it. Or any big place. But maybe it does happen, and if it does, thank you, God. He got on the phone with the business office. He said, she's working full-time. She's a student full-time. She's not making any money. It's all going to bills. And what can you do for her? How little will you take? They took $10 a month. And as long as I made the $10 a month payment, they paid for two radioactive treatments. I was headed for thyroid storm even after the second one. And I'll never forget the man. I have forgotten his name. I will look it up someday, or maybe I'll come across it. But I will never forget him. And that's the kind of medicine I expect when I go to the doctor. I expect somebody to see the person and to be with that person 100% at that time, which are high expectations. But I've walked out of doctor's offices. I've not been rude. I've paid for my visit, and I've never gone back.
Do you see that? So now, you know, with your any recent doctor visits you've had, how do you see it different? Do you see it to be more or less?
Let me answer first your question about hospitalizations. Okay. When I was 63, I was diagnosed with atrial fibrillation. The doctor in Orlando became my doctor by default. I came in through emergency. They said, "Who's your cardiologist?" I said, "Smart mouth that I am," said, "I didn't need one until I came in here." And they got me back in sinus rhythm, and I'm in the bed, and this doctor walks in and introduced himself, sits at the foot of my bed, and said, "Well, we're ready to discharge you." I said, "That's good. They tell me I need a cardiologist." And at this point, I already decided I liked him. He was a real mensch, you know. Do you know that word?
No.
A real human person, you know. That's a Yiddish word I picked up in New York. just you know, you could tell he was like you. I think you're a mensch. You too, probably. But I don't. Anyway, so I said, they tell me I need an electrician. I called up an electrician. I said, are you one of those? He says, happens to be my specialty. I said, good. Are you taking new patients? Will you take this one? He said, sure. He's Dr. Haste, wonderful man, Cuban American, came over on a exchange program in the good old days, and then somehow stayed or came back. Mm-hmm. And is this U.S. citizen, is wonderful. Anyway, so he kept me, and it was because I was older. I thought, well, that's a lousy excuse. Everybody doesn't have this. Anyway, when I was 65, I was back in the hospital. I'd been in a couple of times, but this time they couldn't get me back into sinus rhythm. And we're going to send you home. I said, what part of I live alone? By then, everybody was gone. My children were grown. My husband and I had divorced, and he had died. So I lived alone. I'd been living alone since 1990. Yeah, that's right. 1990. No, not totally alone because I still had kids. I don't know, but you know, but I'm living, you know, with another adult. I've been alone. I can't. I live alone. I don't live in a place where I can walk to a store. You know, no. And he said, walk. Show me how you walk. So I walked. I'm like, all these things. And he said, yeah, you're right. You're not going anywhere. You know? And so then he gave me choices, and one of them was cardioversion. Oh. So will I be asleep or will I be awake in the hospital? Like in the hospital. And he, no, no, you'll be asleep. I said, okay, fine. They had to do TE to get down there. Mm-hmm. So I'd make sure I didn't have clots. And they found an atrial septal defect. Mm-hmm. Turned out to be a good sized one. And so they did the cardioversion. And then he referred me to a pediatric cardiologist in Orlando who happened to be one of his patients, who immediately referred me to Shands Pediatric Cardiology, and that wonderful lady doctor, who may still be there, she was head of the department at the time, had an Arabic name. Don't worry about it. It'll come to you later, too. See? It doesn't happen just with age. And Dr. Paolillo, Dr. Joseph Paolillo, did the surgery. Now, before he did the surgery, Shan said I had to have an ablation because, you know, once they sealed you up, they couldn't get into the left atrium. Okay, so I came up and I had the ablation on January 28th. Yeah, of 8 years ago. No, that's not right. Help me with the math. 60, I'm not 73 anymore, I'm 76. Golly gee whiz. So, and I had the ablation in, I can't figure the math. I think it was 10 years ago. I think it's 10 years coming up on that. Anyway, I'll figure out the math later. It put me in the ICU. They woke me up to tell me, which was my first thought, you woke me up to tell me this. But what I said was, I did everything you told me to do exactly the way you told me to do it. I'm not taking the rap for this. Can I have a phone? I need to call my priest. Wasn't that hard? And then I went back to sleep. They banged around, they had that two-headed catheter. Mm-hmm. And it was, I guess it was new to them, and with the fellows there and everything. I don't know who did. It doesn't matter. But they didn't know where the blood was going and whether it was going to stop. It stopped. It was in the, it was embedded in the left, the rear wall of the left atrium. It took months to get over that, but I spent 4 days in ICU while they had everybody, you know, on standby to see. And that was good to know. But an experience I could have done without.
Right.
Anyway, and then I came back in May after the January surgery, and they did the helix implant. Mm-hmm. Piece of cake. That was really easy. Yeah. Exactly what he said it would be. You know, 3 days in the hospital and then we send you home. Unfortunately, being a pediatrician, he didn't realize that when you give me Lasix, is it Lasix that they give you for incontinence? Does it make you go?
Oh, like Miralax, yeah, or Colace or anything like that?
No, for to make you pee.
Oh, to pee.
Yeah, they can give you Lasix.
Well, yeah, he gave me something. And then discharged me. And I had got this drive home, you know. I stopped at every pit stop. I left the hospital in Depends because I was just urinating all over the place.
Wow.
So I got home dry, though. and everything was fine. And that was the best. That was a life changer because I was so, I had been so tired all the years I was teaching that I didn't know, you don't notice it. You know, you're on a, well, like med students and like interns, you just keep going till you keep going till you stop and then you crash.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how my life was. I woke up tired and I went to bed exhausted. And when I retired and I didn't have to do things, I would go for my morning swim. And then the rest of the day was like, oh, I'll get up and I'll do something. And or I go for my morning walk or the exercise. And I was becoming a vegetable and not enjoying it much. And it made such a difference. There's still a lot of things I don't do or can't do, but it's, I can work around them. I, you know, and yeah. I still get tired, but tired is different from exhausted and stick to the chair kind of. So that was a blessing. So that's been good. And then I came back here. I moved up here in February of 2017. No, 2016. No, I bought the house in 2017. And I went to Shands because we didn't know anybody here. And my personal experience was not with the doctor, but I was not impressed with the infrastructure. I wasn't getting the kind of attention that I require.
Mm-hmm.
And it was too hard to get a message through and this will answer your email in 2 days. That didn't happen. It took 6 weeks for one that I really mattered. I switched to another practice about, and in that time, and since I moved up to Gainesville, this is medical, my body just seems to be behaving differently. My eating habits haven't changed much. I'm probably a little bit more active because I have this child that I deal with. And I was on warfarin for a number of years. And one of the things my body does, I have some autoimmune stuff. They haven't named it because it's not bad enough. And every time I get sent to a rheumatologist, we come up with the same thing. Yes, you've got something, but you're doing this, this, and this. We can't do any more for you at this point. We don't know what it is. We don't think it's this. We don't think, you know, it goes like
right.
that. And that's fine with me,
mm-hmm.
you know. So anyway, so I had a stroke in May 4th. Don't ever want to have another one. My INR was 1.5 when they brought me in.
Gosh.
Should not have been. But I was so blessed. A friend was up to me from Orlando, and I was standing at that counter in there, ready to toss the salad. And I all of a sudden, the leg started tingling.
Mm-hmm.
And then I lost it. And so I'm on the counter like this, and then the right arm decided to go, and the phone was there, and I thought, son of a gun. But Jan came out of the bathroom, and she said, are you all right? I said, no, I think I'm having a stroke. And the ambulance came right away, and
wow.
We went to North Florida. They were right there, like in the movies, you
yeah.
know, with the head of neurology and all these people around,
right.
and explain. And that's the other thing, when you're dealing with patients or when you're dealing with anybody, don't presume they understand as much as you do. You know,
right.
this was all new territory. I know ASCs. I know AFib. I can talk a storm on that. But I knew nothing. This is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. And I could speak, so I could converse because my emergency list, that was here. My medication list, that was here. But I could fill them in on all that.
Mm-hmm.
Now I have one of these ding-dongs around me. It makes everybody happy. Well, it keeps everybody from worrying, including me. I take care of a 7-year-old now. And if something happens in the middle of the night from a stroke, AFib isn't going to kill me. I'm used to that.
Right.
But a stroke? So I've taught him how to push the button, and he sees me. He can check it once a month to see that the monitor is working.
Yeah.
And hears the voice, so he knows what to do.
That's awesome.
So I've been in and out, you know, and other things. I've had all my female organs removed and...
Mm-hmm. And so do you think I'm just always curious based off, you know, I wasn't alive in the 60s, so I don't know what it was like, but I would imagine it was on, you know, there wasn't an electronic medical record. There wasn't all this emails and all this other stuff. So everything
Typewriter.
Was more, exactly. So everything
handwritten
was
notes.
Right. Everything was more personal. And
yeah.
so I'm just wondering what we can do to help make it personal.
I think the constraints of the system in which you work is something to consider. I don't know this is how Shands works, but I suspect that they are on a very rigid, that the doctor is on a very rigid, so many minutes per patient. Because even before you see the doctor, you see a PA or somebody else, a couple of somebody's else. At least I did. And I'm only speaking my own personal reference. I know better than to generalize. But I think that when you're large, when you're any institution, medical or anything, I taught for a community college for a number of years, and that's where I retired from. And we were wonderful. If we had a student, you know, that had a problem, I could get right over to the counseling department with them. I could walk them over and hand them over to the chair, and they'd be able to help them. Well, you lose that when you get bigger. You have to make appointments and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I think what always happens when you get too big too suddenly as an institution, the end user is the one that suffers. I don't doubt that the staff suffers too, but the end user is the one that pays the bill, you know, the one that can't reach the physician, that can't reach the counselor, that can't reach the advisor, that can't reach, you know, somebody to help them in any field. So I think whatever system that you work in, the doctor has to become accepting of that, or at best be comfortable with it and really like it. I think when you're saying you've got to do 10 minutes here and you've got to be done by 15 and you can't, I think you lose that. And I don't make snap decisions as easily as I used to. Probably I'm just being sensible. Mm-hmm. But I can remember, so what would I advise you? I would advise you, I go back to when you are in the room with the patient, that is the only person in the room you're with. And as hard as some of us can be, especially as we age, I'm not a difficult patient. I follow. Mm-hmm. And if I want to change something, I always check. But I ask a lot of questions because I don't have an advocate with me. Mm-hmm. And I have to advocate for myself. And up here, I feel like I'm pieces parts for the most part, you know, because I'm new. I've kept my primary in Ocoee. And I've kept him because he's got a record going back 15 years on me. Mm-hmm. And he's a sweet little Filipino doctor. And he was the first one that sat there at the computer comfortably. And he would talk and but he's also not, you know, here, take this, take that. And these ads on TV should be banned. Ask your doctor if you shouldn't take. Yeah. If I have to ask you what I should be doing, shame on you.
Probably shouldn't have the MD.
But be patient, you know, you can't coddle us, mm-hmm. but treat us. And we're old. It doesn't mean we're all senile and we're all, you know, right. incompetent. And none of us is used to aging. I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and she is a year younger, avid tennis player, just had a knee something, not a replacement, a scraping of something that they said might work. Not working. It's been several months. And I said, well, you've got two choices. You can sit and fret over it. I mean, there's things I'd like to do. I can't do anymore. You find a way around it. You outsmart it. It takes more time to do things, but if it's important to you, you do it. I have a baby blanket I've been working on, knit and crochet, for a couple of months now. I can't knit as long as I used to be able to. The hands don't want to do it. And I have this ridiculous schedule. It'll get there eventually before he goes to preschool. Don't know, it's a thought that counts. But you just have to, you can't go forward if you're looking this way.
Right. You know, so. Absolutely.
But yeah, just be with us. And be attentive to the nonverbal. Alan Alda, mm-hmm. MASH, yes. And a wonderful actor, wonderful human being, has just come out with a new book, another book. He's very big on communication and funds a program up in, co-founded and funded a program up in Stony Brook, New York. If I understood you, would my face look this way? That's something what the title is. I bet it's very readable. I have a friend who's reading it now and says it's really good. And so I'm going to read it. I would recommend that for, you know, kind of light reading. we've lost the ability for nonverbal because we don't look at people. When I was at the theater one day, it was intermission. I just get up to stretch because everything goes stiff and I can't walk. So I just get up and, you know, move around. Young couple in front of me, obviously dating. It's intermission. Talk to each other. You just seem to have a play. No, he's on his pluses and she's on her pluses. And I thought,
so true.
I know. This is how I look and I don't understand. And I even say to my grandson, this is my, I don't understand a word you're saying. He's trying to teach me. But Pokemon I'm getting better at. But he's got Yu-Gi-Oh. Yeah, Yu-Gi-Oh. Oh, he's 7 years old. And he knows all these names. We're going to play cards while we're still at the practice game thing. Because Grams asks questions and doesn't understand. It's a delight.
That is awesome.
Well, I don't know whether any of this is usable.
No, I think it's wonderful. No,
I've had a very wonderful life.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And there have been low spots, but yeah, that's life. It's, you know, life is always change. Exactly. Nothing comes to stay. Everything comes to pass.
Right.
So if it's something good in your life, make the best of it for today.
Absolutely.
And I wish you two the very best in the of careers and lives.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so
much. We need more good doctors. And geriatrics is it's like going to Mars, you know? Nobody knows. Of course, if they put out a handbook, you know, a lot of us would probably opt not to do it, you know? There's a lot to be said for only knowing what's happening today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, it was really an honor to hear about all of your stories. You're such an accomplished, being back then, you know, for a woman to have gone to like masters, like two masters.
Oh,
you're so accomplished.
I was the first one on either side of the family. I was the first college graduate, the first master's degree level. And then I taught ESL for over 41 years.
Yeah.
Wow. Did you taught in college as well?
Hmm?
At the community college?
No, I've taught K through 12 and adult ed and refugee education. And I taught a group of Filipinos in the days when the Navy had stewards who were essentially valets to the officers.
Really?
And they changed that right to cook. They don't have stewards anymore.
No, I mean, for me as a female, it's a very inspiring story. So I really appreciate it.
And is this off the record now?
Oh, yeah, we can stop it. Yeah.